Medusa representing Hard Knock, the hard knocking on your radio on 94.1 KPFA. What? With the way you feel it.
This is Reefer One Rock Rebel putting hits on the devil. When I'm not listening to Hard Knock Radio, I'm out painting this urban canvas we call the Bay Area with some fly pieces. So tune in, y'all, Monday through Friday, 94.1 KPFA. 4 to 5 p.m. Yeah.
Hey, yo, this is Ice Cube coming straight from a hard knock life on Hard Knock Radio. Do what we do, baby. Yay, yay.
There ain't no grace can hold my body down. There ain't no grace can hold my body down.
Good cold evening, gentlemen. Amongst your inventory, I've been led to believe is a specimen I'm keen to acquire.
When I hear the trumpet sound,
what's your name?
I'm on a rise right out of the ground.
Django. Then you're exactly the one I'm looking for.
Hey, stop talking to him.
Calm down. I'm simply a customer trying to conduct a transaction.
Last chance, fancy pants.
Oh, very well.
You know what a bounty hunter is? You kill people, and they give you a reward.
Better they are, bigger the reward.
I need your help. I'm looking for the Brittle Brothers. However, I don't know what they look like, but you do. Don't you?
They caught my wife, and they sold her, but I don't know who took.
That means we visit every plantation until we find them. Once a final Brittle Brother lies dead in the dust, I agree to give you your freedom. And I'll take you to rescue your wife.
Where are we going?
Yes!
Gentlemen, you had my curiosity, but now you have my attention.
How do you like the bounty hunting business?
Kill white folks and they pay you for it? What's not to like? I like the way you die, boy.
He is a rambunctious sword, ain't he?
What's your name?
Django. The D is silent.
Want to say what's up to everybody. Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. And what we want to talk about is a movie and the surrounding issues of that movie that we haven't seen the likes of in a very, very long time. We're talking about Django, or actually Django, and the type of conversation it spurs all across the nation. Pro, con, issues around slavery, who gets to talk about these sorts of things, historical accuracies and inaccuracies, and what have you. And we have a wonderful roundtable of filmmakers and cultural critics that are going to be joining us, but we wanted to kick this conversation off this afternoon with a good friend of ours. He's a professor. He's a historian. He's somebody who wrote a very detailed article in the New Yorker. He's also a contributor to MSNBC and CNN, among other things. We're talking about Professor Jelani Cobb. Jelani, welcome, man. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Let me just start off with the obvious question. Are you surprised at how much conversation movies like Django have generated, including getting you to, write an article?
I'm surprised by it. I didn't expect it to, well, one, I wasn't expecting the movie, the film, to be what it was. And then I was surprised that it garnered the reaction that it has and that the conversation has been so intense and so enduring. So, yeah, it was telling that, you know, we avoid slavery. We usually avoid discussions of race in this country. And now we're like deeply enmeshed in a conversation about race.
Is it because we are so hungry to have that information that we haven't talked about that any opportunity we were going to jump on the bandwagon, so to speak, and really weigh in?
I don't think so. I think it has something to do with the precise and particular nature of this film.
Okay.
I think we hadn't seen anything quite like this, before or recently. And it opened up a door for us to have a conversation about how, not only about how we perceive slavery, about the actual history of slavery, but how we perceive it and how we imagine it, and what is appropriate. What are the proper ways to discuss, these horrific elements of the past? In what ways do we not want to discuss it? I think all those things were wrapped up in this film.
Right. Let me ask you this. If you could kind of give some bullet points of your wonderful article in The New Yorker that you really wanted to get across. I know you did the analysis with that and Inglourious Basterds, but you also put some accuracy in terms of history there, which is really your area of expertise.
Right. So let's start with this. When I first started talking about the film, the first thing people would say is that, the criticisms I raised about history were, invalid, or we shouldn't be talking about this because the movie never purported to be about history. And I didn't think that was a valid argument because in reality, when we think about Westerns, most Westerns never said that they were actually depicting events from, the history of the American West, but they still shaped the ways in which we understood, the ways in which we viewed the West. And right. So I remember the Native American writer Sherman Alexie saying that he had to grow up to understand how wrong it was that he would watch the movies, the Westerns, and cheer for the cowboys, not the Indians, right? And so the ways in which history can be shaped, our perception of history can be shaped, is sometimes easier in a film that doesn't purport to be about history than one that does. Right. We look at, Lincoln, for instance, we're going to be looking to see whether or not something is accurate. But we have something that's supposedly fictional. Sometimes those messages come through even more clearly. And so my concern with the movie was, manifold. One, given his track record, in previous movies,
Quentin Tarantino,
the director, given Tarantino's track record in Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown, I wasn't comfortable with his use of the word nigger as often as it was used. I mean, some people said, this is a movie about slavery. If ever it's appropriate, then it's here. But given the fact that he's used it in excess in films that had nothing to do with slavery, it seemed that the movie which was about slavery set up a kind of valid excuse to use a term that he already has a fixation with. And it was used with such numbing frequency that I think I said in the article that had he used the word one more time, it would have required billing as a co-star. and so there's that. In addition, there were some kind of implications of it. So we see this film about an ex-slave, a rebellious ex-slave who's set on a mission, who turns bounty hunter and goes on a mission to save his still enslaved wife from a plantation which is owned by a character played by Leonardo DiCaprio named Calvin Candy. And so in the film, the only individual we see who has a real antagonism towards slavery, the only person who we see who's willing to be violently rebellious if necessary is Jamie Foxx's character, Django. And I thought that did violence to the history of slavery. Mm. We understand him as he said, Calvin Candy says at one point, as one person in 10,000 who's willing to violently fight against slavery. And he later sarcastically refers to himself as that one person in 10,000. But that's the inverse of it. We know the history of slavery is that there's been lots of resistance, not just simply the one hero who rides in and decides that he's had about enough.
Right. Well, I think your comments, and for those that are listening on radio, we're talking with Jelani Cobb, and those who are watching, Jelani Cobb is on our screen with us. The whole comparison with the Western, I think, is very telling because that has shaped our opinions about the West. Many people now justify the taking of land, and they reference those Western movies directly or subconsciously. And even more importantly, it's made the Native American either become the noble savage, who speaks very infrequently, just says one word, hi, Tonto, or whatever. And it, for the most part, they've been invisible with our history. So that I think is very problematic. And the last point, which I'll make, which I think is also interesting, when I saw Django, there were big advertisements for the Disney all-out blockbuster remake of The Lone Ranger and Tonto. So we're going to have a rewriting, or we're going to have a reintroduction of that Western narrative coming down the pipe in a minute. We're going to be having this conversation in a couple of months, except we're going to be dealing with the Native American experience, because most of the people I know who are Native American, especially in the age of Idol No More, they ain't having it. They're not having Tonto show up on the horse and support this this character the way that he did in years past.
And let's bear in mind that Tonto is being played by Johnny Depp.
That's right. He is Johnny Depp. That's right. So they couldn't even get a Native American actor.
Right, right.
Go ahead.
I think those were the concerns that I had. That simply saying that something is fantasy doesn't mean that it doesn't reflect how we think about history. And it doesn't shape how we think about history, moving forward. And so in addition to that, there's a character that they create, which is played by Samuel L. Jackson, a character named Stephen, who is the stereotypical house slave who immediately becomes an antagonist of Django. With spoilers, if you haven't seen the movie yet, you might want to close your ears. But, Stephen is the last person that Django has to kill in order to be free. And they set it up that his true antagonist, Django's true antagonist, is not Calvin Candy, the plantation owner, but is Stephen, the house slave. And I thought that was very presumptuous and disrespectful, for a white director to set up that kind of dynamic wherein you have a black person, the really ultimate fight is between two black people in slavery. Mm-hmm. I thought was duplicitous and disingenuous.
Right. And it's also, it sets a precedent that you see play itself out throughout the history of TV.
Yeah, I think it would have been much more powerful. I mean, they try to make this character seem like he's something more than simply a bootlicking, servile, self-loathing individual. I mean, they have a couple of points where they show or try to show this person is smart and he understands what's going on around him. But ultimately, at the end of the day, his main purpose in the plot is to prevent someone from getting the freedom of his wife. And so there was when I was looking at the play, it reminded me of dynamics that took place when I saw Inglourious Basterds, which is Quentin Tarantino's more recent film, most recent film. And Inglourious Basterds, if you're not familiar, is a alternate history of World War II. Involves a band of Jewish soldiers, American Jews, who were sent to Germany in order to kill Hitler. And they, along with the assistance of a Jewish female theater owner, conspire to kill Adolf Hitler. And this is kind of how Hitler meets his end. I thought it was a really well-done movie. I thought it was a fascinating kind of spin on actual historical events. But when I saw it, I went to Moscow to teach for a semester. In Russia, people really hated the film. Mm. And I didn't understand why. And the reason for that was simply that, Hitler's death was brought about through enormous sacrifice from the Russian people, from Soviet population. And the Soviet Union lost more people than any other country during World War II. It's estimated they lost about 26 million people. And, because they feel that the world has never properly recognized their loss of those 26 million people, and because they feel like their sacrifices have gone unnoticed, particularly in the United States, they were not receptive to the story of an alternate history. You can't present an alternate history when you fail to grapple with the actual original history. And that's how I felt about you know, the problems implicit within Django Unchained.
Right. Well, you know, Jelani, we can go on, and we are going to continue on with our roundtable discussion. One quick question, if you could briefly summarize two or three points about Lincoln, you know, using your historical understanding. What's missing in Lincoln that definitely should have been there?
The shortest summary is black people.
No Frederick Douglass in Lincoln.
There's no Frederick Douglass in Lincoln. As I understand, Frederick Douglass was part of the original script, but did not make it into this draft. And you know, the story of black people in history in general, like there and originally, and then somehow or another didn't make it into the final version. And so the Lincoln that we see in this film is a fully formed moral individual, understands that slavery is abominable and has to be ended. And Lincoln took a long route to come into that position. The other thing, he's brought to that position by the constant pressure placed upon him by people like Frederick Douglass, by black people who were enslaved, you know, who are consistently escaping and trying to join the Union forces, and the Union trying to having to figure out what they're going to do with these people who have this very ambiguous status. And so these things place pressure on Abraham Lincoln to adopt increasingly more progressive positions as it relates to slavery. Beyond this, the film makes crucial or fails a crucial decision that Lincoln is a opponent of slavery because he advocates racial equality. In real life, in actual history, there was no reason to suspect that Lincoln believed in racial equality.
Right.
He disdained slavery, that is, he disliked slavery, but he did not believe that blacks and whites were equal. And in fact, at various points, his ideas for emancipation were partnered with his plans for the removal of the entire black right. population from the United States.
The deportation. I'm going to stop you right there, Jelani. We appreciate it. We can look for your article in the New Yorker magazine. We can see you on panels and frequently on MSNBC and other places where you are sharing your information. We're going to open this up and let our panel weigh in because they're chomping at the bit. And I think they're going to be able to build off of the foundation that you laid out this afternoon. So, ladies and gentlemen, Jelani Cobb, thank you so much, man. We're back here. Big shout out to Jelani Cobb, who was breaking down a lot of history for us. Well, we now want to turn our attention to our panel discussion, and we have some esteemed folks that are in the building with us. They are filmmakers. They are image creators. They are community folks who really push the envelope in terms of changing the perception that us as African Americans are dealing with. And among the folks that we have is filmmaker Idris Hassan. She is over here with us this afternoon. I'll let her talk about some of her projects. We also have Sean Kennedy, well-known entrepreneur in the city of Oakland, and also somebody who has put out a project called Good News Oakland, designed specifically to change the image that has plagued this city, and in particular, its African-American residents. And then we have Dwayne Dudefill, somebody who's a cultural, I'll call you a cultural ambassador, somebody who's part of the Maroon Society that's dealing with images, and he is here to join us as well. Let me start off with you, Dwayne. We've been talking about Django and using this opportunity to look at the institution of slavery, unearth history that's been buried, and to look at some of the issues above and beyond. And as I was saying with Jelani, this movie sparked something within many folks. Absolutely. To really start coming and talking about it. We haven't seen this in a very long time. I mean, Oprah did a special. They did a special on, you know, free speech. I mean, everywhere you go, and it's like, let's talk about this. So what do you think is really driving this?
Well, it's the thrust of the Hollywood's power in terms of putting images in the public eye. It's not as if slave narratives or the African enslavement narrative hasn't been covered in film before and covered much, much better. So I wanted to, you know, along with what you're saying here, differentiate between the slave narrative and the narrative of enslaved Africans in America. So that's the main difference, I think. Also, that this type of a slave narrative is more palatable as entertainment. In other words, you have the snipped off, you know, cultural heritage basically of these African people in the Americas. The slave narrative is more palatable and commercially viable than is the narrative of enslaved African people, like you would find in a film like Sankofa or Quilombo and things of that.
Well, when you look at some of those films, like a Sankofa, you're usually dealing with rebellion.
Yeah, absolutely.
And some people have made the case, well, this is an empowering film because we did get to see somebody rebel. So what's the difference between a Sankofa and what we saw with Django? Even though we know it's fantasized, but...
Sure. Oh, huge, huge difference. Again, there's the difference between Django being someone whose personality seems to emerge as this white man whose name is King Schultz comes and gives him some purpose in life and also superimposes this German myth narrative on top of his journey. He becomes Siegfried now. He's, you know, journeying after Brunhilde because he's, you know, he's Siegfried. This is something completely different from what you would find in Sankofa, whereas you have Akan philosophy showing up in Sankofa, the Sankofa bird, the notion of return, right? And so there's a spiritual journey that this woman goes through in Sankofa as she's freeing herself. She kills the person that rapes her in the film. She's an empowered black woman, which you don't find in Django as well. You find the empowered black woman, and you find empowered black men in there, like Shango is leading this maroon rebellion in the hills, and he's portrayed by the great rap and reggae artist named Mutu Baruka. Mm-hmm. So you have different narratives going on, and those they're qualitatively different things. Django is an individual whose, you know, personality emerges, like I said before, as he's given purpose by this white man, and he becomes one in 10,000, as William Jelani Cobb, you know, brought off for right. us here.
Let me bring you in, Idris, filmmaker. Somebody who, you know, from my understanding, got behind the camera because you didn't like the images that were out there. You were like sick and tired of being tired, you know. When you see a movie like this come out, and maybe you can share with us some of the work that you're doing, does it enhance it? Does it mean more opportunities? Or does it create more of a challenge for you?
Wow. This movie is very interesting. For one, like you said, it is sparking a lot of dialogue, a lot of conversation. There's opinions across the board. Is it a good movie? What is it doing? Is it, you know, he's freeing the people. It's empowering for black people. But at the same time, I think when you have a machine such as the Quentin Tarantino machine, he's almost in some ways rewriting history. People are now quoting a Django film as examples of history. Oh, Samuel Jackson, that's exemplified as the House Negro. That's who you look to as the worst House Negro you've ever seen in a documented format. But and I think that's where it becomes problematic. In my work, I try to do a lot of documenting of things that are happening in the community, everyday occurrences like Malcolm X jazz festivals, people doing art, people reaching out to kids, women telling their stories about dealing with domestic violence. And a lot of my work does cover the spectrum of the African-American community, again, because I feel that in our history, as we've seen filmmaking come into play just as a medium, The Birth of a Nation and those kind of films always dictating this is how black people are going to look, and this is how European folks are supposed to deal with them. And I think that the Django is bringing that same play into it, even though he's at the end.
Well, you said something that's interesting to me, because a lot of the discussion around Django has been, you know, just to kind of summarize a typical narrative, is that if we put this false history out, our kids are going to soak it up, and then they're going to think that's what slavery was about, it, blah, blah, blah. But you just kind of alluded that, you know, there's other people that's watching this. You know, it's not just black folks. When I saw it, there was no black folks in the theater, but it was sold out, you know. And, you know, this is on the borders of Texas, you know, and it was sold out for a week. You know, I had to wait like 4 or 5 days before I could actually go into a theater that seats 300 people to see it. You know, and that's how popular it was. So the question becomes, should we be concerned how other people will perceive this and then react?
I think definitely yes, because I was with you, the theater I went to was mostly Europeans. Watching this film, and you could see where the niggerisms came in, and they're making fun, and Samuel Jackson's being just really, I don't know the word, but you could see the European folks were laughing. It was amusement, and there was, look at this. There was funny parts, too, but these parts that I'm talking about weren't the funny parts. Mm-hmm. There was amusement happening where it wasn't funny, where there was atrocities, where there was degradation, there was laughter, but and vice versa, where there was retaliation, where there was the so-called empowering scene for Django, silence.
What if Tyler Perry did this movie, or Spike Lee did this? Would we have a problem with it? Is it really because it's, you know, Quentin Tarantino that's doing this, white guy doing it, you know, and, but, you know, what if you did it? Or, you know, or somebody else, would it make a difference?
It depends. It depends. I don't know if the Tyler Perrys of the world necessarily go and consult history verbatim when they're dealing with the film. Even Spike Lee in some cases, I don't know if he's quoting history verbatim when he's producing his films. So there are some challenges there. But for me, it's like, okay, well, European folks have told our stories for so long. Maybe if Quentin Tarantino didn't do it, it wouldn't be so much of a spark. But because he did do it, there is some kind of outrage. There is some kind of, oh my goodness, what's going on?
You have Reggie Hudlin as mm-hmm. a producer. Mm-hmm. You have Jamie Foxx and Samuel Jackson. You have a star-studded cast. And can we deny the fact that there are a lot of people in our community that thought this was an empowering movie? There were many people, you know, Jamie Foxx talks about crying on the set and the whole nine. So is there some value to that, or?
I would say yes, yes and no. To some degree, there is a value, again, because it is presenting a narrative of enslaved Africans that maybe a lot of masses of black people haven't done that level of research. They don't even know the basis of what happened to us during the Maafa or, you know, transatlantic slave trade. So to see something on film where it's like, all you've been taught is that you were a slave, that's your history. And you see somebody empowering and killing. And, you know, when he whipped the white man before he was about to whip the sister, I was excited. I admit it. But overall, it's just like, we need to dig deeper into our own history. We need to dig deeper into our own narratives and really understand, like, who is the real Django? Do that research? I hope that this film would spark that kind of thing in folks.
Sean Kennedy, you know, we were on a panel a long time ago, maybe about 5-6 years ago, and you had brought up something. We were talking about the Afrocentric period in hip-hop, when everybody's talking about Fight the Power and everybody was wearing the Malcolm X chains and all that. And I remember you talking about that. Yeah, folks wore those hats and folks wore those chains, but they're also selling dope, putting things behind them, and didn't necessarily pick up the meaning. And I want to bring this up and start off with that, to your journey of somebody who has, you know, deliberately trying to change the image of Oakland. At that point in time, there was a renaissance in black entertainment where everybody was saying, if only we had more images. So you had Spike Lee do his Fight the Power thing. You had the Public Enemies. You had the KRS-Ones. You had an onslaught of images. But from what I gathered when we were on that panel, there was a lot of people that just didn't pick that up. Or maybe they did and they just didn't really digest it in the way that we would see. And now, you know, some odd years later, 20 years later, we have somebody like yourself who's changing the images or the perception using film and using all that information. And I want to, you know, from your perspective, what do you think about, you know, what's happened over 20 years in terms of what we digest, what we don't digest? And what is it really going to take for us to start taking in images critically and moving in another direction in terms of how we perceive?
Well, when it comes to what we digest, I think we are just spoiled to the fact that there's this big table of food and we just sit down and eat without thinking about the things that we are digesting. It is these images that continue to come at us that are well-designed images that are created by people who are psychologists who actually graduate with these PhDs that create the things that we are about to digest. And the unfortunate part about what has happened over the last 25 years when we did have this level of consciousness, like you said, I question the fact that what did this level of consciousness mean? You know, I wrote a rap back in the day when I was a rapper, like every other kid was, and I said, a little quote was, you wear the African peace sign on your neck, but you just killed a brother for a 6-count on the set. What does it mean? Is it life that you value or a bullet to the brain for a scandalous power? And so I saw a lot of that, you know, brothers on the street being conscious, but yet still dead with that thing around their neck that was supposed to liberate them from everything else, you know. So what has happened, I think, is that our culture was studied even then, and it was tested. It was given back to us in the things that we were doing, and it was sold to us. So I think over that period of time, when we talk about the Spike Lees and the Public Enemies and those type of groups that were trying to change our image back then, I think that the popular image, and it prevailed, was the NWA image. And the reason why that image was popular, because the gangsters was really hiding behind the African peace sign. They was really gangsters. They was really gonna do that anyway. That was just a cover. Right. You know what I'm saying? It was just a shield to say I was something else that I wasn't. So what I think the industry did was just really capitalize on that by continuing to feed and create the marketing strategies that it took to keep that media inside of our face.
Talk about with Good News Oakland. So you come from those rough streets in East Oakland. You've seen the type of negativity that is often associated with the city. You know, I remember teaching a class and showing them a headline coming out of the San Francisco Chronicle. One was from 2002 when there was a celebration in Oakland after the Raiders went to the Super Bowl. And the other one was the headline in that same San Francisco Chronicle when they lit about 6 or 7 bonfires in San Francisco. And I showed the class, and one in Oakland said, you know, raving maniacs, you know, upset the city of Oakland. And then the one in San Francisco was like, you know, delirious fans, you know, party hard in the street as they're setting bonfires. And you see the same picture, you know, cars flipped over and all that. But I brought that up to the class to say, like, wow, this same paper in the same area, but look at how, you know, here you had just one car that was flipped over and burnt up, and it was like the entire city was just a thug city as a result. Here you had buses being smashed, you know, windows being broken, all kind of stuff after the Giants win the World Series, and it's just delirious fans partying hard, you know, and that sort of thing is plagued many, not just in Oakland, but in Detroit, Chicago, any place where you find large black populations. So talk about the, you know, understanding that sort of dynamic. What is the approach that you've been taking to now try to change that image using some of these tools that have been used against us?
Well, now we're, you know, the bigger picture of all that is that's institutional racism. So, I mean, that's a whole nother can of worms, but the tools that we have today that we didn't have before is the fact that we have the internet, we have YouTube, we have bloggers and things of that nature. We have places and domains that we can put our own story up and let people read what's happening in our current day culture and history. What brings me to say, I just finished teaching an oral history class, video oral history class with young people, and my job was to let them tell what's happening right now, their story during this historic period of Barack Obama and the things that are happening in America. And we never hear that narrative, because that narrative is when you go to the libraries or the archives and you look for the stories and the headlines that talk about the things that were happening during that time. You only see those headlines that were written by individuals who had other things in mind other than, you know, looking out for us. So now we live in a day that we actually are archiving our history because of social networking, and we are able to tell our own story. So now we have the power, like right now, you know, to have cameras that's this big and do a television show didn't exist, you know what I'm saying?
Not even 3 years ago.
Yeah, not even 3 years ago, right? But now we can do that. So we have the power now to change it because of the internet and social networking, and that's what we need to do.
What I want to do is I want to take a break, and when I come back, I want to bring you all in and also be joined by Donna Lisa Fisher, professor at SF State. I want to go back into time and kind of deal with it from this standpoint. People talk about, well, it's just a movie, you know? These are just movies, why are we tripping? But there were some landmark movies that came out in the 70s, and one of them, which we've never escaped and had, I think, the biggest impact, was a movie called Superfly. And it came out along the same time as the movie The Mac. It came out the same time as Spook Who Sat By the Door. Came out the same time as The Legend of Nigga Charlie and Soul of Nigga Charlie, which was actually Django before Django, right? But the thing with Superfly was it had all the bells and whistles. And there are documentaries online that talk about how the fashion changed. And the filmmakers are proud. Like, we made people start wearing long trench coats. And people stopped wearing afros. And they started wearing perms. And here we are 40 years after that movie. And people still quote it in rap songs. And they still reference it. Even in the way that they talk about their swag. And so, can a movie just be a movie? Understanding, as you said, the machine of Hollywood. Understanding the types of impacts. And if we can have a 40-year legacy just on a couple of movies, in terms of, like, you're seeing, like, people who weren't even born still reference that and still are informed by that, then what sort of things do we need to do so that they can go in another direction permanently and not, you know, live off a certain type of legacy? So let's take a break, and we'll come back and we'll continue. We're back here. We're talking about Images, Django, everything beyond. We have filmmakers, professors, cultural critics, the whole nine, the diaspora in our community. We have Idris Hassan, a filmmaker. We have Sean Kennedy, entrepreneur and the creator behind Good News Oakland. We have Dwayne Dederfield.
Dederfield,
jazz expert. Part of the Maroon Society.
Oakland Maroons Art Collective.
Thank you. Yeah. Oakland Maroon Art Collective. When you say the word maroon, automatically go to Sankofa and the whole nine. So, okay.
Beautiful.
There you go. And then we have Donna Lisa Fisher. She's over at San Francisco State. She teaches a number of courses. Among them is technology as well as black images. And so we want to talk to her as well. Before we left, I wanted to take us back to a movie like Superfly. But alongside it, there was a bunch of movies. The Mac would be another one. And it was a period of time in the 70s where these were just movies. And many people were excited to see them. The themes are kind of similar in terms of what we're looking at when we see Django. You know, the downtrodden, the underclass, the person who you least expect is going to come up and save the day. And I use Superfly as a referencing point because when you look at the documentaries around it, they talk very deliberately about they wanted to change the fashion statements. They wanted to change the lingo. They wanted to change a whole lot of things. And they brought this character named Priest, who, for many people, when we were growing up, and we couldn't see that movie in the theaters, and there was no YouTube and none of that stuff. So we were too young to go. We saw the posters and we thought he was a pimp. It wasn't until I was an adult and got to see that movie that I realized he was a cocaine dealer. And he was snorting cocaine like every 2 minutes in the movie. And then you listen to Curtis Mayfield, and he's like, the movie soundtrack is great, but I was afraid people might glorify cocaine. And at the time people said, no, Priest will be that hero and people will get the message. But 40 years later, you know, cocaine has been more than just glorified in our communities. The whole pimp culture or whatever is something that is with us to this day. And a lot of Priestisms are still around. So I want to start with you when we talk about it just being just a movie. Using that, you can look at The Mac as another example since we're here in the Bay Area. Same sort of impact. and a number of other films that have really gone on to inform our art.
Yeah. I want to say just in general, though, the whole issue about it being just a movie, one cannot reduce the power and efficacy of Hollywood film, because the narratives and the myth-making that comes out of Hollywood in many ways is much more powerful than actual history. It's much more powerful. It moves the masses much more powerfully than actual history does. So the whole thing about it just not being a movie, and matter of fact, the paradox is that because the audience thinks of it as just being a movie, that's mainly what gives it all of its power and belief, is because they casually take in these images and falsehoods. But there's I want to contrast a couple of movies and show what happens with some of these things, right? So Shaft comes out. And Shaft has a protagonist and a hero in it who's raising money basically to get some brothers out of jail who are in a radical movement.
Right.
So the backlash against Shaft really was Superfly.
Yes.
Was to, again, make this individual who's not doing really anything for the community.
So Shaft is basically reflecting the militant times of the 70s.
Exactly. And the entire notion of the blaxploitation flick is a backlash against the black arts movement, which has come up since about 1968 or so in full power, really. And so they take things that were, a lot of it being African-centered and having radical politics in it and wearing of African clothing, things of that nature, and they try to commercialize it. When I say they, I mean the empowered white males in Hollywood who saw an opportunity to make money off of it and turning it into something commercial, empowered themselves to turn it into a fashion statement. And if you make something that comes into fashion, you can have something that goes out of fashion. So it's a way, I believe, of shutting down the power of the black arts movement, which is basically the cultural wing of the black power movement. This is right. What was expanding things abroad. I want to make one more contrast, which is the movie Spartacus, which is also a so-called slave narrative, but it's from ancient times, right? But you have it written by this cat named Dalton Trumbo who was blacklisted, and the hero Spartacus is actually trying to free slaves, right? Free all these slaves, a whole group of folks. Fast forward then to the year 2000, you have the movie Gladiator, which people talk about a lot too. Gladiator really is this guy who works for the Roman Empire, and he's basically doing things for himself. You see what I'm saying? So they always shift things from being for community, for masses of people, and once they figure out that, oh, wait a minute, this narrative has come up that is for empowers the masses of people, they change the narrative so that it focuses on an individual and the individual story. So now we look at Django and compare Django to Sankofa.
Right.
Or some of these other movies, you know, like Quilombo and things of that nature. Django is, you know, is insidious in that manner.
One point with that, and then I'll bring you in, Don, going back to the individual. One of the things that stood out with me with Django was he never really talked to the other people that were enslaved.
Exactly.
He never really, it was never like, brother, you know, we're free, let's go do this together. It was very much an American, like, it's me only.
1 in 10,000.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
1 in 10,000.
Donna
Lisa.
That was an. I had to just jump in on that one because that was striking to me. That of course there's an obvious juxtaposition of Django versus Sankofa, but having studied the legend of pejorative N-word Charlie and all of its sequels, Fred Williamson, and all of these personalities, and also Dave Chappelle's remix of it in Time Haters. So Dave Chappelle has this skit called Time Haters, where these pimps travel back in time and hate on haters. So they do something to Hitler. And the last one in their time machine skit is that they go to a plantation and he shoots a white man on the overseer or plantation owner. I'm actually confused about it right now. But so Time Haters, when you look at the legend of Charlie and the media, the Fred Williamson in the middle, and then the character who would have been Samuel Jackson's character in the past, but and the other character, that's who Charlie Murphy and the Chappelle's cast were embodying. And it was the three of them together. Now, one does play that scared person and run off right before he shoots the plantation owner, the white man. But what's interesting and about the both Time Haters, the remix of this narrative, and The Legend of Charlie, which are our non-progressive narratives, right, is that
it's the community together. Billy Preston's song called Inward Charlie is about Charlie, he needed his brothers. We did it together. And so I was shocked. But not, I shouldn't have been shocked, but I was the juxtaposition, not just Django versus Sankofa, but Django versus the Legend of Charlie versus Time Haters, where it's us together. It's just like, F y'all, I'm not even, I mean, it wasn't just the white mediated, why don't you guys free yourself? Like, really, you're going to hand this person a gun and they're not going to shoot you? Like, seriously, and run off even if it's to death?
That's wild.
Like, seriously?
That's wild.
But I mean, it was just, it took... It made The Legend of Charlie seem, which is poorly made, seem progressive. So I just had to jump in on that individual versus...
Well, let me ask you another question. I want to bring in the rest of our panel. You teach a class. You've been teaching Black Images for a while. From your students, what do they take in? I mean, are these just movies? And knowing that students are taking in a lot of things, I think Sean was talking earlier. We have YouTube. We have a lot of things. So it's not like the movie is the big event like it was even 10 years ago. I mean, there's so much information going. So since you teach a technology class and you're teaching Black Images, when you were before these classes, you know, with students, 18, 19, 20 years old, what is the mindset, you know, when you're dealing with them? How do they interpret, you know, many of these things that we're talking about?
Well, first of all, I have to give enough respect to all of y'all for the critical media literacy work that you all do every day to help us free our minds, free ourselves, raise our self-esteem, and a constant barrage against us, our identity. Stuart Hall says, popular culture is where we learn about ourselves, right? And so if we're getting, every day our kids and our peers and our seniors are getting images about, are getting information about themselves from the avatar that they have on their Words with Friends or Scram, whatever the newest game is. The avatars are white, right? The avatars are white and overwhelmingly male. Not even just that black-white binary. There's not representation of any identity, Asian American, Native American, etc. So the avatars on our games are white. The avatars in our video games are white, or this blaxploitation image throwback. But also, how we deal with our media, how this on-demand media consumption is very short. So I wanted to just jump to, so of course it has an effect on us, it has an effect on our self-esteem, it has an effect on our everyday practice. So, I mean, this work is very important. My two sound bites that I want to say is if people really want to learn about slavery, if people really want to learn about critical media literacy at the university, it's not going to be from Quentin Tarantino or even Spengler and Goldman. It's going to be from an Africana Studies course. There are classes where we learn and where we read the original text, and there's resources. So if we want to raise awareness through these films, that's one thing, but there's actually ways where we can learn about it. I have to say one last thing, though. I saw Django in the movie theater close to campus where Davey D and I both teach. And so I was in the theater in an interesting situation with my mother, who's 64, or somewhere around there, you know, and went to segregated schools all through, even through college, it was segregated. She had to travel outside of the South to get to an integrated school. And our students, who are 18. And my mother and I, you know, when we left the theater after the movie, the 2 hours and 45 minutes, right. she was shocked. So I was like, wow, this must, but I, you know, it's Quentin Tarantino, it might've been all the blood and like the man being torn apart by dogs, these graphic scenes for a 60s, which were hard for me. I couldn't look. I don't do that.
Right.
So I covered my eyes like I do. But the 18 year olds that do watch this often, that are used to it, were shaken. And I saw some of our students, African-American students, on the phone crying. Like literally, there's this one young lady in the bathroom on the phone crying to her mother, talking about how she just saw this movie. And I thought,
was she crying out of empowerment or?
No, she was upset. My theater was different from some of my colleagues. Dr. McDougall saw it in Chicago, and he said black people were laughing and so forth. I don't know.
Right.
But I'm saying my theater wasn't like that. In Daly City where I saw it, the white older white men in front of me were like this. Like on their knees, like this, and some of our African American students were angry, upset, having emotions, and so I thought, well, some of these people literally are the same people who I've taught Roots to, And there's that moment where I cry every semester where Madge Sinclair, Belle, is her Kizzy, her baby's being born, and the father off the Brady Bunch. Right. I forget his name. The actor, he's whipping her, and she's like, "Mama, Mama." And she's like, "No, Massa, not my baby." It makes me cry every time, the idea of her baby being sold. But that's a 1 minute clip in color adjustment by Marlon Riggs, and then it recovers with the Cosby Show. So what my point of this sharing the story is, I don't think our students, or in that matter, many people of a particular generation, are used to sitting through 3 hours of those kinds of graphic images. We log on, we see a video clip, we may even see a 10-minute clip, but to be sitting stuck in a theater and you can't multitask or text, well, you're not gonna really text if it's a good movie, right? Or if you're engaged. To sit there and watch those graphic images one after another, I think had an effect. Okay.
Which makes us start to question now and want to really turn the critical eye on Quentin Tarantino for having criticized Roots for its quote-unquote authenticity. Like, how does he do that? How does he empower himself now to start speaking about that particular narrative, which is actually based in a real history? Right. You know what I'm saying? It's really based in some real history. And I think what you're saying is true. I don't think the overwhelming majority of the public realizes that Roots was a long series of films, right, you know, that went over a period of
and
week.
Also sparked a lot of fights in places.
It was a cultural phenomenon at that particular time, and was one of the most watched television shows ever. At that particular time.
We're going to take a break, and we're going to conclude our roundtable discussion on the movie Django, or actually Django and Beyond. I want to thank our guests, William Jelani Cobb, historian. I want to thank Donna Lisa Fisher, out of SF State. Want to thank filmmaker Idris Hassan. Want to thank Sean Kennedy from Good News Oakland. And I also want to thank Dwayne Dederfield. Again, we will continue this tomorrow on Hard Knock Radio, part 2 of our discussion on Black images, Django, and Beyond. We'll be right back. Peace.